Okay, please turn to 2 Chronicles chapter 18. We've been talking about the kings in the southern kingdom, which is what the writer of Chronicles, focuses on. One of the exceptions is the chapter we'll be looking at, where the northern kingdom comes in a bit. Last week we looked at the first part of the reign of Jehoshaphat and saw that he was evaluated very highly, compared favorably to David, and commended for his work of reformation. And we focused especially last week on the teaching ministry that the priests and Levites were given again. It was a renewal of the original charge that they had been given, as we saw at the institution of the system of worship. And we traced through, so we spent a long time talking about the importance of their teaching ministry. And today we're going to look at something very different. This is the account of Jehoshaphat's foolish alliance with the northern kingdom and Ahab. And it's one narrative which fits together very tightly. It's actually a very interesting story, just from the point of view of being an account. And so it's kind of, for that reason, hard just to break it up and comment on various pieces of it. It's just an interesting account to read. But I'd like to read it all at once and then go through and make some comments on it. So please listen as I read 2 Chronicles chapter 18. Jehoshaphat had riches and honor in abundance, and by marriage he allied himself with Ahab. After some years he went down to visit Ahab in Samaria. And Ahab killed sheep and oxen in abundance for him and the people who were with him, and persuaded him to go up with him to Ramoth-Gilead. So Ahab, king of Israel, said to Jehoshaphat, king of Judah, "Will you go with me against Ramoth-Gilead?" And he answered, "I am as you are, and my people as your people. We will be with you in the war." Also Jehoshaphat said to the king of Israel, "Please inquire for the word of the Lord today." Then the king of Israel gathered the prophets together, 400 men, and said to them, "Shall we go to war against Ramoth-Gilead, or shall I refrain?" So they said, "Go up, for God will deliver it into the king's hand." But Jehoshaphat said, "Is there not still a prophet of the Lord here that we may inquire of him?" So the king of Israel said to Jehoshaphat, "There is still one man by whom we may inquire of the Lord, but I hate him, because he never prophesies good concerning me, but always evil. He is Micaiah, the son of Imlah." Then Jehoshaphat said, "Let not the king say such things." Then the king of Israel called one of his officers and said, "Bring Micaiah, the son of Imlah, quickly." The king of Israel and Jehoshaphat, king of Judah, clothed in their robes, sat each on his throne. And they sat at a threshing floor at the entrance of the gate of Samaria. And all the prophets prophesied before them. Now Zedekiah, the son of Kenana, had made horns of iron for himself, and he said, "Thus says the Lord, with these you shall gore the Syrians until they are destroyed." Dave likes these props here. And all the prophets prophesied so, saying, "Go up to Ramoth-Gilead and prosper, for the Lord will deliver it into the king's hand." Then the messenger who had gone to call Micaiah spoke to him, saying, "Now listen. The words of the prophets with one accord encourage the king. Therefore, please let your word be like the word of one of them, and speak encouragement." And Micaiah said, "As the Lord lives, whatever my God says, that I will speak." Then he came to the king, and the king said to him, "Micaiah, shall we go to war against Ramoth-Gilead, or shall I refrain?" And he said, "Go and prosper, and they shall be delivered into your hand." So the king said to him, "How many times shall I make you swear that you tell me nothing but the truth in the name of the Lord?" Then he said, "I saw all Israel scattered on the mountains, as sheep that have no shepherd. And the Lord said, 'These have no master. Let each return to his house in peace.'" And the king of Israel said to Jehoshaphat, "Did I not tell you he would not prophesy good concerning me, but evil?" Then Micaiah said, "Therefore hear the word of the Lord. I saw the Lord sitting on his throne, and all the host of heaven standing on his right hand and his left. And the Lord said, 'Who will persuade Ahab, king of Israel, to go up, that he may fall at Ramoth-Gilead?' So one spoke in this manner, and another spoke in that manner. Then a spirit came forward and stood before the Lord and said, I will persuade him. The Lord said to him, In what way? So he said, I will go out and be a lying spirit in the mouth of all his prophets. And the Lord said, You shall persuade him and also prevail. Go out and do so. Therefore, look, the Lord has put a lying spirit in the mouths of these prophets of yours, in the mouth of these prophets of yours, and the Lord has declared disaster against you. Then Zedekiah the son of Kenaanah went near and struck Micaiah on the cheek and said, Which way did the spirit from the Lord go from me to speak to you? And Micaiah said, Indeed you shall see on that day when you go into an inner chamber to hide. Then the king of Israel said, Take Micaiah and return him to Ammon, the governor of the city, and to Joash, the king's son, and say, Thus says the king, Put this fellow in prison and feed him with bread of affliction and water of affliction until I return in peace. But Micaiah said, If you ever return in peace, the Lord has not spoken by me. And he said, Take heed, all you people. So the king of Israel and Jehoshaphat, the king of Judah, went up to Ramoth-Gilead. And the king of Israel said to Jehoshaphat, I will disguise myself and go into battle, but you put on your robes. So the king of Israel disguised himself, and they went into battle. Now the king of Syria had commanded the captains of the chariots who were with him, saying, Fight with no one, small or great, but only with the king of Israel. So it was when the captains of the chariots saw Jehoshaphat that they said, It is the king of Israel. Therefore they surrounded him to attack. But Jehoshaphat cried out, and the Lord helped him, and God diverted them from him. For so it was when the captains of the chariots saw that it was not the king of Israel that they turned back from pursuing him. Now a certain man drew a bow at random and struck the king of Israel between the joints of his armor. So he said to the driver of his chariot, Turn around and take me out of the battle, for I am wounded. The battle increased that day, and the king of Israel propped himself up in his chariot, facing the Syrians until evening. And about the time of sunset, he died. Let me just read the first three verses of the next chapter. Chapter 19. Then Jehoshaphat, the king of Judah, returned safely to his house in Jerusalem. And Jehu, the son of Hanani, the seer, went out to meet him and said to King Jehoshaphat, Should you help the wicked and love those who hate the Lord? Therefore the wrath of the Lord is upon you. Nevertheless, good things are found in you, in that you have removed the wooden images from the land and have prepared your heart to seek God. As I said, this is a very interesting and engaging account, and that makes it all the harder for me to kind of break it up and make comments on this part and that part. It's unusual in the Book of Chronicles in that this is drawn almost entirely from the parallel passage in the Book of Kings, in 1 Kings 22. Very little change. The chronicler usually assumes knowledge of Kings and uses portions of it, but rarely does he use so much, with so little addition or deletion. And so I thought it would be helpful before we talk about, go through the passage in a little bit of detail anyway, to talk about some of the background and maybe to give something of an overview. As I said already, we've seen in the last chapter, Jehoshaphat is introduced as basically a faithful king who sought to reform the worship of God, sought to encourage the teaching of God's law in all the land. And the account that's given here shows that the chronicler doesn't have this sort of a cardboard cutout view of spirituality, like, you know, the good people are always good and the bad people are always bad. Jehoshaphat comes out very clearly here as in the account overall in Chronicles, as a faithful man, but as a man who made foolish decisions and who bore the consequences of them. And you can see, even in the chapter, Jehoshaphat goes down to Ahab, who is a professed worshiper of Baal. That was the whole orientation of Ahab's kingship. He turned the northern kingdom in that direction with the help of his wife, Jezebel. He enters into an alliance with Ahab. He goes down there, and you can sort of see him getting more and more stuck in the situation. He says, well, you know, shouldn't we inquire of the Lord before we go up? So he inquires of the Lord, and this guy makes this remark about how he hates this one true prophet. He gives him this sort of lame rebuke, like, you know, you really shouldn't talk that way, you know. And then when he finally does hear the word of the Lord from the one true prophet, what does he do? Well, he basically ignores it, right? He goes out to battle anyway. And yet, with all those negatives, there are positive aspects. For example, in the middle of the battle, when he's about to be killed, it looks like, he cries out to the Lord, and the Lord delivers him, which is a basic theme of the chroniclers. And the chronicler, in a positive direction, that is calling on God in the time of trouble. And of course, at the end, the reason I read the last part is the divine evaluation of what Jehoshaphat was doing was that it was a bad alliance of loving those who hate the Lord. So I wanted to stress that because although the chronicler does try to put his lessons right on the surface of things, if you seek the Lord, you know, God will bless you. And if you turn away from the Lord, bad things will happen. He doesn't have a very simplistic view of life, like, you know, the good people never make foolish alliances and that there are not trials and temptations even for the faithful ones. That's an important point to keep in mind, I think, in reading the books. The other piece, the other thing I wanted to say before we go through it is just to look a little bit at what's going on in the context in Kings. And so let's turn to 1 Kings chapter 20 and 21. Well, okay, so we'll start in 1 Kings chapter 20. As I said, the chronicler really is assuming that you know the background. And I think that's maybe more apparent in some places than others, but... excuse me. In 1 Kings 20, there's some helpful information for us. Ben-Hadad, whom we've already seen, right, is a ruler of Syria, or as the newer translations sometimes call it, Aram, the same thing, the kingdom centered in Damascus. Now, Ben-Hadad is mentioned at the start of 1 Kings chapter 20, gathering his forces, and there's a description of the battle, and ultimately of Ahab's triumph in the battle, more for God's glory than for Ahab's, because the king of Syria thought that maybe God was only the God of the hills or maybe just the God of the plains, and God wanted to correct that misimpression and so gave Ahab the victory. It's part of a larger context, but I want you to want to point out a particular in verse 34. This is after Ben-Hadad has been captured, and Ahab has foolishly says, you know, he is my brother, Ben-Hadad. He's not going to treat him harshly. It says in 1 Kings 20:34, "So Ben-Hadad said to him, 'The cities which my father took from your father I will restore, and you may set up marketplaces for yourself in Damascus, as my father did in Samaria.' But Ahab said, 'I will send you away with this treaty.' So he made a treaty with him and sent him away." Now, he was later rebuked for doing this, but the point I want to make here is that Ben-Hadad promised to return some cities which had been taken, and it seems quite likely that this Ramoth-Gilead we read about was one of those cities. In other words, Ben-Hadad didn't follow through on his promise. Rulers are quite often like this, I suppose we all are, but he didn't follow through on his promise made under duress to return these cities, and that's probably the... the occasion for this battle that Ahab wants to enter into to recover Ramoth-Gilead. The other thing I'd like to point out in the context is the is that what happens in this account is prophesied as a judgment upon Ahab. And the chronicler doesn't mention the, shall we say, gory aspects of the conclusion of that prophecy. But in the next chapter in Kings, in chapter 21, is the account of Naboth's vineyard. Remember, Ahab, the king of the northern kingdom, really wanted this vineyard of Naboth, and Naboth quite rightly refused to sell it to him. And Jezebel, who was the wife of Ahab and the daughter of a Sidonian king, knew how the Sidonians operated in situations like this. Right? We didn't have these constitutional restrictions. We just get rid of the guy. And so she led the way and essentially had him murdered. Had Naboth murdered, although it was really under a false accusation of blasphemy. Ahab was implicated in all of this, and the judgment that comes is important for this. The judgment from Elijah starts in verse 20 of chapter 21 of Kings, and I think I'll skip over some of it, but it says specifically... Now, this is pretty gory stuff. Verse 23, "And concerning Jezebel, the Lord also spoke, saying, 'The dog shall eat Jezebel by the wall of Jezreel.' The dog shall eat whoever belongs to Ahab and dies in the city, and the birds of the air shall eat whoever dies in the field. I'm sorry, I skipped over. Yeah. I didn't have myself oriented properly. Let me read verse 19 instead. Sorry. He shall speak to him, saying, Thus says the Lord, Have you murdered and also taken possession? And you shall speak to him, saying, Thus says the Lord, In the place where dogs lick the blood of Naboth, dogs shall lick your blood, even yours. And in Kings, that's the conclusion of the account of the battle at Ramoth-Gilead, this is the gory part, Ahab is wounded, he bleeds in this chariot, and they wash out the chariot, and the dogs drink up the blood. Sorry, this is the kind of stuff they talked about more in these days, in those days, than we do in ours, I suppose. But that judgment then on his wife Jezebel is also referred to later in Kings. And in between, the verses I skipped there talk about the cutting off of the line of Ahab. And the other thing I guess I'd say in the context is immediately following this prophetic word from Elijah, it says in verse 27 that when Ahab heard these words, he tore his clothes and put sackcloth on his body and fasted and lay in sackcloth and went about mourning. There was at least a show of humility on Ahab's part, and the Lord, for his own reasons, then said that he would not withhold judgment, but would delay judgment, I guess is the best way of saying it, in terms of the cutting off of the kingdom of Ahab. So that's some of the context in Kings, which I wanted to bring up before we launch into Chronicles. Any comments or questions so far? Okay. So Jehoshaphat is mentioned here, then back to 2 Chronicles 19, as the, I'm sorry, 2 Chronicles 18, as having riches and honor in abundance, which is an account of what we have already seen in the previous chapter. The Lord blessed him richly, even in material ways. And then it adds, and by marriage he allied himself with Ahab. Now, the marriage is the marriage of the daughter of Ahab, who is Athaliah, to the son of Jehoshaphat. And Athaliah, the name might ring a bell with you. She's the one who later tries to work the same sort of things in the southern kingdom that her mother worked in the northern kingdom, and ultimately tries to slay all of the seed royal, all the heirs to the Davidic throne she attempts to kill. And so, obviously, this is not a good idea. Okay, this is to have serious consequences for the later aspects of the promises to David. But that mention here is probably the occasion for his going down to Samaria. Going down to Samaria is precise geographically because Jerusalem is higher than Samaria. He's going north in the flatlands around here. If you go down, that means you're going south, I guess. But he went north to Samaria. And I know it's not completely flat. Drawings in Texas, what would I know? But the description then of the alliance is probably the occasion here for his going down to Samaria. And Ahab puts on something of a royal dinner for the fellow, right? We have this sheep and oxen in abundance, and it says at the end of verse 2, he persuades him to go up with him to Ramoth-Gilead. And the word that's translated persuade is used in other contexts as entice, like to entice someone to do something wicked. And that's the idea. He's trying to get him, get him to do this. Ultimately, of course, it's not a good thing to do. So the response that's given in verse 3, there's a question then in verse 3, will you go with me against Ramoth-Gilead? And the answer, I am as you are and my people as your people. We will be with you in the war. Just at face value, it's kind of a crazy thing to say. My people worship Jehovah, the Lord God of Israel, and your people worship Baal. But my people are as your people, and we'll go with you in this battle. That's the kind of the sense of it. But it's probably more like formal language to say, we have a treaty, and we will go with you in this battle. Ramoth-Gilead was, as I said, a contested city, one that Ben-Hadad, or one of his fathers, one of his ancestors, had seized. It was a strategic city on the across the Jordan River, basically on the border between Syria and Israel, the northern kingdom. And so he had a tremendous interest in recovering the city, and he wanted Jehoshaphat to help him in the battle. That's the kind of the setup of things. And the response of Jehoshaphat in verse 4 seems to be somehow to qualify the consent he's already given, or to seek maybe more information, shall we say, before he buys into it wholeheartedly. And so Jehoshaphat says to the king, please inquire for the word of the Lord today. Now this is a godly thing to do. This is, in fact, what kings are often commended for, seeking the Lord in various aspects. Now this is also something that was done in other lands as well. I mean, other heathen nations saw their gods as coming to their aid in holy war. So, in a sense, you know, no one could have argued with this request. Jehoshaphat could well have argued with the results that he got in terms of who showed up. So he says in verse 5, I'll go at this pace, we'll never go through this one. The king of Israel gathers these prophets together. He has 400 of them. It's an impressive number. You remember earlier in Kings that there was a confrontation between Elijah and the prophets of Baal, and a good many of them were slain, or at least were commanded to be slain. It's quite likely that these fellows are really prophets of Baal, but they know that won't fly, so they pretend to be prophets of the Lord. In fact, they speak in the name of the Lord. They use the word God here, but later on they refer specifically to Jehovah. So whether they what exactly their background was, they at least profess to be prophets of the God of Jehoshaphat. And the answer is, of course, go up and God will deliver it into the king's hand. So, this is not very surprising. This is the way prophets keep their jobs, is, you know, by giving the answer the king wants to hear, as Micaiah will be told later on. And one commentator pointed out that how even in modern examples of foretelling, like palm readers or people like that, whenever you hear stories about these guys, they're always telling you things you want to hear, right? They don't say disaster's going to come upon you. So this is the way people keep in business, is by saying things that prophets saying things that the kings want to hear. But it wasn't the way godly prophets operated, obviously enough. In fact, the common pattern throughout Chronicles is that the prophet comes to the king with something bad to say. It's fairly unusual for a commendation to come, as we already read at the start of the next chapter. Jehoshaphat was rebuked at the start of the next chapter. And so, in any case, these 400 with one accord speak this supposed word from the Lord about his success. I've been referring to several commentaries, but a commentary by Trapp, who was a 17th century Puritan, had a lot of good sayings on this chapter, one of which I thought was, a couple of which I copied down. He says, their number shows that truth may not ever be measured by the poll, which I thought had a modern ring to it. Not sure exactly what sort of poll they had at that point. But, I mean, it is a fact, right? Here is the fellow Micaiah, one guy with the true word from the Lord against 400 who say exactly the opposite. You know, the polls are clear. What are you going to do, Ahab and Jehoshaphat? Of course you have to do what the prophets who outnumber the others say. But Jehoshaphat, yeah.
400
Yeah, with all the props, you mean, and everything? Yeah. Yeah, it didn't look like Micaiah had access to the proper. But yeah, I probably skip over that. But it is true that these sort of props, like using horns and so forth, were, that's not obviously a distinction of the false prophets. There were others, Ezekiel and Jeremiah and so forth, who used accessories, as you say, in their prophesying. But, I mean, the horns, that's pretty convincing, to charge around with horns on the head. Anyway, any other comments or questions? Okay, I really am not going to get through this if I don't hurry up a little bit. Jehoshaphat gives him this rebuke. He has enough spiritual insight to realize that these are not prophets of the Lord. Whatever they may say, he says, is they're not a prophet of the Lord here. And Ahab gives this nasty answer. You know, there's this one guy, but I hate him. Ahab, for all of his faults, at least spoke his mind, right? I hate this guy because he always tells me bad things. There's something refreshing about that, even if it's a wicked thing to say. But, Jehoshaphat gives him what I would call a mild rebuke. Let the king not say such things. And so Micaiah's called in. The scene then that's described in verses 9, 10, and 11 is the scene which may actually be going back to before this little conversation about...